Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Brought to you by the Desai Group. I'm your host, Stone Payton, and with me is my producer and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Stone. How was your weekend?
It was marvelous. I didn't do anything but play video games with my kids, and that's part of what I'm going to do when I get back after the show.
Ah, busy day.
Yeah, they're not in school today. You know, today's a big day in our history.
That's right. Tomorrow.
Yeah. No, it's Dolly Parton's birthday.
Oh, there you go. Didn't realize that.
No, of course, we're celebrating Martin Luther King Day, and we're swearing in our new president tomorrow, so we got a lot going on this week.
How's the Innovation Awards coming along?
Oh, it's going great. We're having, of course, as most of our listeners know, we've got the executive session that we're doing here in Atlanta, Georgia, on Thursday, February the 19th, and then we're going to throw everybody into a fur-lined, four flat-screen equipped adult beverage-stocked bus and shuttle them out to the party out at Rome, Atlanta. And so we're lining up sponsors and printing up VIP party passes and all kinds of cool stuff.
It'll be a good time.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun. And we've got a great show for you this morning. First up is, this guy's going to be fascinating. I just know he is. I'm not going to spoil much of it with the introduction, but I will let you know, among other things, this guy runs his operation out of a helicopter hangar. His name is Dr. John Shufeldt. He's a lawyer, a pilot, and CEO of an organization called NextCare. Welcome to the show, Dr. John.
Stone, happy birthday and thank you.
Oh, thank you. Got a ton of questions to ask you, but before we do, let's set a little bit of context. Can you just give us a little bit of background on NextCare and what you're out there trying to do for folks?
Yeah, you bet. I started NextCare in 1993. I'm a practicing emergency medicine physician, and you know, I was working in the emergency departments after residency and thinking, boy, they're paying me a lot of money to see these patients who really don't have conditions that warrant an emergency department. I'd come from and still work at a big level one trauma center and a tertiary care center, and I'm seeing people who have, you know, bronchitis and coughs and urinary tract infections, what have you, who really don't need to spend, you know, $800 to $1,000 to be in the emergency department when they can go someplace else for about a tenth of the cost. And kind of got me started thinking about urgent care, so I opened up the first one in Arizona in 1993.
Wow. And so how many facilities do you have now?
We have 44.
And what do you do differently that we would recognize as a customer of your services if we were to walk into an urgent care versus maybe some other, a next care versus a typical urgent care situation?
Sure. It's, you know, we're kind of high-tech and high-touch. It's we really want to get people into the system quickly. We're very customer-oriented. We do a lot. We're completely paperless, so patients can register online. They can wait at home before they come in to see us, and we'll call them up and let them know, hey, your room's ready in a half hour. You know, why don't you head out now? They can put all their data in online, all their demographics in online. So when they really get to the urgent care center, we're really just focused on their care and not on a bunch of paperwork and collecting copays and all things that patients don't like, and we certainly don't like to do either. It's just kind of a nature of the beast at this point.
Why do you think that in healthcare they're so slow in moving to paperless?
You know, that is a great question. I don't have a great answer. It is expensive to go this route. It does take a lot of time and a lot of internal resources. And I think physicians just, you know what, I'm spending my time in patient care. I don't want to spend my time on trying to reinvent the wheel here or do something out of the ordinary. This works for me. I'm just going to keep working for me. I'm just going to keep doing it. And unfortunately, it's kind of short-sighted. We went to electronic medical record a number of years ago and have spent about almost 13,000 hours developing this program that was a pretty sophisticated program when we bought it. And so we've really customized it quite a bit for our own business and for urgent care. But I think without those kind of resources and perseverance, you know, physicians just say, you know what, paper works fine. And it really does contribute to the rising cost of health care. It definitely lowers quality of care. And we've seen it as a huge, we've had a great return on investment for it.
You've put a lot of these systems, I'm operating under the impression that you put a lot of these systems and services in place before you ever open the doors. Is that right?
You know, part of it is, but part of it was, you know, once we got the doors open, I was like, you know, if we just did it this way, this makes a lot of sense. And, you know, just learning from the errors of our previous ways and continually kind of retooling the business to make sure that we're doing as much as efficiently as we possibly can. we see about 500,000 patients a year. So, you know, our mantra is if we can save a dime, if we can save a patient 2 or 3 minutes of their of time, you know, that 2 or 3 minutes per patient adds up to a lot of minutes in a day. And that adds up to staff costs, getting staff home earlier, less overtime. So it really does add up. So it sounds kind of ridiculous, but, you know, we look for ways to, you know, save a dime here and there and to save a few minutes here and there.
Now, when it is paperless from the customer standpoint, like say I'm a client of yours, and then I have to go to a specialist. How does that information transfer to that specialist?
We give the patient a copy of their electronic medical record when they leave, and all their images on a CD-ROM, and so they can just bring that CD-ROM to their patient, to their specialist, and say, "Here's what they did for me," or they bring it back to their PCP, which, and you know, patients are kind of notorious for this. What do they do for you there? I don't know. What kind of medications they give you? I don't know. And so here's a letter. Here's exactly what they came in for. Here's exactly what we did for them. And here's how we sent them back to you.
I like that. I tell you what, I'm your target demographic probably. I have a gymnast and a soccer player. Do you ever go to your sweet spot, your customers, your target demographic, and ask them what else they would like to see in the experience?
We do. We send out an email survey to every patient 3 days after their visit, and we call every patient up 2 days after their visit just to make sure, have you made a follow-up appointment with your doctor yet? Are you getting better? Can we do anything else for you? If you're not getting better, do you need to come on back in? And then we send out an email survey with us, what else can we do for you? And we scorecard we scorecard the physicians on customer service. So, in fact, I was just looking at it before this phone call. We rank the physicians by their customer service scores.
Wow.
So there's a physician who says, mostly, you know, would you recommend this provider? And that physician gets low marks. I'm going to be on the phone with them in a few hours here saying, you know, help me understand why your patients rate you an average of 6 out of 10 when they, you know, would you recommend this doctor?
Now, can you share something that you learned from your clients in these surveys that you were able to implement in your system?
Oh, you bet. You know, we have these kiosks at all the centers. When they walk into the front desk person says, "You've been here before, blah, blah, blah. Let me direct you over to this kiosk." And this kiosk is a touch screen, much like when you go to the airport to check in, very similar to that. And it goes through a bunch of questions, a bunch of historical questions, so the patients don't have to answer it every time they come in. It just updates their chart electronically every time they come in. Well, some feedback we got was some patients just aren't that computer literate. So we started having what's called a concierge, someone who greets them at the front door and walks them through this process so they're not really intimidated by this computer when they sit down at it and start going through the process. So it's kind of more, it's very hand-holding, but it's very customer service focused. And it really started because patients said, you know, we're not too into this high-tech stuff yet.
Now, what really drives this innovative side of yours? Are you is it just your brain, or do you have a team, or you use outside consultants?
Well, we have a really great management executive team that all work in concert, and you know, the nice part about it is that there's no yes people on it, and in fact nobody ever really agrees with me. So it's really a nice way to banter back and forth these solutions until they come up with a best solution. But my personality is such that I don't like to see something that I think I could improve. I don't like to sit there and not try to improve it. And so it's, you know, always tease our team, okay, well, I have no new initiatives this year, and they all laugh and say, you know, you can't go a day without thinking of something new to do a better way to do it. And, you know, we kind of have a group that's not afraid of change, and that certainly helps.
How do you manage those kind of, like, you need the contrarian voice in that room? But how do you manage that from, like, the person that's always negative, that, you know, is always just kind of poo-pooing the idea rather than embracing the...
You ask great questions. You know, I've had somebody, like, I've had a few people over the years like this, and I just sent an email last week to one of them and said, look, if I'm listening to the radio and all I keep playing is the same song, I'm going to change the station. Because, you know, this kind of was, why don't you listen to me when I say something like this? And I said, look, all you ever say is that. All you ever are is contrarian to this, which is all good. But eventually, people tune you out. So you really need a different way to bring it up. You know, hey, here's a solution that may work a little better, as opposed to this solution won't work. And once you start changing your presentation, more people are going to respect and listen to what you're saying. But that's a great question, because it is difficult when someone's always taking the, you know, pessimist, the contrarian viewpoint to everything. And you certainly need those people, but you've got to figure, they've got to figure out a way to get their message heard as opposed to tuned out.
It's great to have a CEO, someone at the top that is passionate about innovation and serious about innovation like you are. But what recommendations, if any, do you have to get the rank and file genuinely engaged day in, day out in an innovative effort?
You know, I think if they see that the management team is as excited and as passionate as they are, if they see that the management team is the first into the parking lot and the last out of the parking lot, that the management team really supports them and does the best they can to support them and what they're doing, and really, you know, kind of espouses what they preach as opposed to just paying a lip service, I think that really generates the enthusiasm. And I can't say we do that 100% across the board, and we certainly have some staff members who, you know, I always tell people, you know, if you're not fired with enthusiasm, you're going to be fired with enthusiasm. and getting that message or communicated across. And, you know, in these difficult times, you know, people really need jobs. And, you know, realistically, I said, look, I'm okay if you don't want to do that. Unfortunately, you're not going to work here. And so make your choice, because I'm okay with either way. But at the end of the day, we're going to do it this way.
How do you identify those good employees? Like, what systems do you have in place that help you find those people that can adapt to the kind of change that you guys must be always putting forth? Because you're always probably trying new things.
Well, a long time ago, there's a mountain in Phoenix called Camelback Mountain, and it takes about a half hour to climb it. So I used to interview people climbing up Camelback Mountain. I'd say, look, my schedule's pretty tight, but every morning at 6 a.m. I'm climbing Camelback Mountain. So if you want an interview, join me. And
that helped weed out some people, huh?
Well, if they complained on the way up, I knew they weren't going to work. Well, obviously, you can't really interview people that way. So we really try to interview for attitude. And if they have the attitude and they have, you know, a little bit of intellectual horsepower behind them, we figure we can kind of train them to do anything. And that kind of started. I went to Disneyland a number of years ago, and I was talking to this guy who was leading this tour, and I said, where do they ever find you? This guy was so enthusiastic and so absolutely into what he was doing. And he said, what was your background? He's like a finance major in college. And he knew nothing about the entertainment industry or actually what he was doing. He said he just had such a different, unusual, and effervescent attitude that, you know, Disney hired him and trained him trained him for what they needed him to do, and he was great at it, and we really took that to heart.
I understand that barbecue and helicopters is part of your secret recipe. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we do. You know, I love to cook, and so I used to do these Royco rib fests in Chicago, and so we kind of brought that out here, and we try to do one a quarter, and we probably do a little more often than that, but we'll have a kind of an employee barbecue, and you know, I'll cook all sorts of different things on this huge pig roaster grill I have out. I have a couple hangers, and I'll gather in the hangar on a, you know, like a sunny Friday afternoon, and barbecue up some food and goof around and have a good time.
So what's next for NextCare, John?
Really is to continue to use our model and identify areas where that model would work and continue to grow. You know, some by acquisition and some by de novos. And, you know, we look at we've got a board meeting today, and we'll really look at, you know, how these economic times are going to impact our business and whether or not to be conservative during these times and you know, cash is king, or continue to expand at the pace we were expanding.
Well, I sure hope you'll come back soon and share more of what you're up to. But before we let you go, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show, where we ask each guest to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career and what they learned from it. Would you be kind enough to do that for us?
Yeah, you probably don't have enough time for me to share. I always tell people I've made every mistake in the urgent care playbook. But the one probably large mistake that's more general that I've made and still sometimes continue to make is I'm not direct enough with people. I tend to soft sell it a little bit sometimes. And, you know, I read that book From the Gut by Jack Welch a number of years ago, and he really talks about, you know, the kind, compassionate managers are not the ones who soft sell. They're the ones who sit down and look somebody in the face eye to eye and say, listen, here's where you need to improve. Because if you just shine them on and shine them on, then they get to a certain age where they do get fired, and then they're unemployable because they're at this age where no one wants to employ them. And so I really try to make it an effort every day to, if someone is not living up to what I believe is their standard, and I always think people can do a lot better than they think they can do, that we need to sit down and say, how can I help you? What roadblocks are you facing? To really perform at your peak best. Because that's what a leader should do. It should help everybody else. It should bolster everybody else with, drag them along with them. Some kicking and screaming, some leading the pack.
And that candid posture really is the best way to serve the person and the organization, even if it means freeing up their future.
Exactly. And it's a tough lesson I've learned repeatedly.
Well, Dr. John Shufeldt, thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to coming to Arizona and conning you out of a helicopter ride and a barbecue sandwich sometime.
Hey, deal.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, bye-bye. Have a great birthday. Take care, gentlemen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, what a great interview. What a neat guy. I look forward to connecting with him again. Well, the fun never stops here, Lee.
The fun never ends.
And we have a local gentleman here in the studio, a gentleman by the name of Randy Walton with the Walton Group. And the timing is so fortuitous because this gentleman is with an organization dedicated to helping organizations plan and execute change more effectively. And obviously that just ties in so well with our theme of innovation. Welcome to the show, Randy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about your firm.
Well, we're a management consulting firm and work with companies anywhere in the $50 million to $5 billion space, which these days begins to define the middle market. But we're working with senior leaders in those organizations who are really trying to drive change within the organization. That change can be something that's, what we would refer to as a point change or point change within a division or group, or a wholesale change of their entire business model or focus.
So tell me, what kind of mistakes do you see senior leaders and their executive teams making when they try to take on something as serious as change?
Well, the first and most obvious mistake that we see, and we see this an overwhelming majority of the time, is a failure to really craft a clear and understood vision that the organization can start to point towards, sort of a lighthouse that they can steer their ships at. They believe that they do that, but they rarely do. And we have a statement that they confuse clarity with certainty, and they get real interested in trying to develop certainty about that future. And in the absence of certainty, they fail to provide clarity. And clarity is a whole lot more important for those people in the organization than certainty about what that endpoint looks like.
Is it possible to find certainty?
You know, I don't know that it is possible to find certainty, and as soon as you do, it's going to change on you. So that's why we really try to move them away from that and to really push them towards developing clarity around what they do know and don't know. And it's fine for a leader or a CEO to look at his organization and say, we don't know what the endpoint's going to look like. We really don't know where we're going to be when this is done. But these are the things that are in play right now, and this is what we're going to do to try to move the organization forward. And that sort of clarity is helpful to people. They can operate with that.
What strategy would you give an organization in this economic climate?
Well, in this economic climate, it's very easy to begin to look at current circumstance and become very tactical in response to those circumstances. Try to make immediate change, try to do things with urgency that doesn't allow for proper planning or proper expectation setting within the organization. And people tend to reveal their worst sides in those moments of crisis and moment of urgency. So very often it's to step back and really ask yourself some very fundamental questions about why you have value in the marketplace and why people want to do business with you, and then begin to align yourself behind those very fundamental and basic components of your organization.
Is it practical to just implement a process of change because I said so and I'm the boss sometimes, or do all change projects of any real magnitude and value require structured methodology and processes and all this stuff we read about in the literature?
Well, you know, there are certainly examples where I'm the boss and I said so works, but right. Those organizations culturally tend to be pretty distinct, very line and command oriented in terms of the way they're managed and structured, and they have other issues that that tend to be limiting to them when you see that in place. The overwhelming majority of cases, you do need a plan and methodology in place. You need a structured approach to it. or you really won't see material success. And if you look at the statistics on change initiatives within organizations today,
not pretty.
Not pretty at all. I mean, I saw a statistic just recently that suggested that less than 40% of the desired value of change initiatives is being realized.
Wow.
Across the board for organizations. That's a pretty poor statistic.
It sure is.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's a tendency to overestimate the strategy or the approach that's being taken. I mean, you set a methodology stone, and I think that fits with what's missing. People believe they have a methodology because they have a plan, and a plan is not the same as methodology. And then sit down and get in a room and agree with each other and consider that wisdom, and it doesn't always work that way. So that lack of a plan that has real capacity for success tends to lead to a lot of busyness, a lot of activity, but things that don't align to a desired outcome.
So is effective change management mostly about anticipating and managing resistance, or is there more to it than that in your experience?
Well, that's a great question. I think resistance is the thing that creates a lot of heartache for people in leadership roles when they're trying to implement change at any level within an organization. We constantly speak to the point that resistance it's not really a relevant issue because it's always going to be there.
Well, that's true.
And so if you're looking to find the strategy or the plan that's going to eliminate resistance magically, you're going to spend a long time waiting to find that, because people become very encamped for a lot of different reasons in their way of doing things. What we do believe is that you have to give people a reason for change in the face of their resistance. Let them be uncomfortable with it, but offer them some business rationale that they can begin to get their heads wrapped around and then begin to understand. People are not unwilling to deal with discomfort. They're not unwilling to deal with change. The change just has to make sense to them.
Can you share some actual case studies that your organization has been involved with, where you were able to, you know, kind of walk us into a situation where a company was in pain and you were able to change them for the better?
Absolutely. A multi-billion-dollar client of mine that was in an industry where they had been a dominant leader in their marketplace for several decades, in fact, slow-moving industry in terms of change in that industry. And there was a tendency to believe that innovation was unnecessary. There was a tendency to believe that they had answered.
They figured it out.
Yeah,
so just keep doing what we're doing,
absolutely,
and it'll all be good.
Yeah, they cracked the code. And
is
they
that
were
GM? Are we talking about GM?
No. But what happened is there was emerging change in the industry that was starting to chip away at the edges in that business. And there was a belief that, well, those are circumstances that are economically driven, or they're one-off kind of instances and situations. And
it's an anomaly. This is not a trend. We have it figured out still. We're
absolutely
going to ignore this, right?
We're going to ignore
new
this.
Data. Ignore the new data.
Yeah, and when outliers in the organization started to kind of raise their hand and say, hey, you know, this is not right. Something's going on within this business that's beginning to have an impact on us in a pretty negative way. There was resistance, and not just resistance by some individuals. There was resistance really at the core, at the senior executive level in the organization, to that change. They weren't interested in listening to that story. And the trick in this particular situation was not to go in and try to win an argument with the CEO and convince him that a change was necessary that he didn't believe in, but was rather to build a case around how significant the crisis was that they were experiencing at that time. In other words, they needed to be emotionally invested in the idea of making a change happen. Whether they knew what the change needed to be, they just needed to embrace the idea that a change was becoming necessary. So we wanted to build some emotional gravity around the issue for the senior leadership team early on, and begin to challenge some of their core assumptions about how their business worked. And it's always a tricky thing to do, because you're really coming in and kind of talking poorly about someone's child, if you will.
Except it's their child.
Absolutely.
It's not someone else's child.
Right.
Absolutely. And I expect them to be emotionally resistant to that. I mean, I wouldn't think much of a leader who just took any flip conversation or any offhand comment that suggested their business model had some flaws and, well, gosh, we got to start over. Those usually aren't very effective leaders. The ones that you want are the ones that dig in. And what we're looking for there is agility. We're looking for someone who's willing to say, I don't really agree with what you're telling me, but I'm willing to have the conversation.
Right. I'm open to the possibility that that might be true, right, rather than I know it's not because I live in this company 24/7 and you don't.
Right. So the first step is always helping them learn how to build a business case for driving change within the organization. And then we start to talk to them about some of the basic tenets of any change process and how a change process needs to work. But it always starts with that, what are you doing today? How is what you're doing today working? What evidence do you see that challenges the assumptions that you've allowed to drive your decision-making in the past? And then can you reconcile those things? And more often than not, when you offer that in a very structured way, they realize they can't reconcile current circumstance with past practice, and something has to change. And so by necessity, we would say that all leadership is change leadership, because if you're not driving towards change, you're just managing. And we're expecting those folks as leaders to really see that and create urgency around that within the organization.
When you were just talking, you were speaking about the present and you were speaking about the past, and you weren't mentioning the future. How does kind of planning for the future or anticipating the future come into play in this?
Well, the one thing that we understand is going to happen 100% of the time is that that fear is an enormous component of a change initiative. Leaders don't often look at me and say, I'm not willing to change. I've had that happen. I've had people
say, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not willing to change. This is how I do it. It's worked for me, and as long as I'm here.
So you go, thank you, bye, and you leave?
Yeah, really. They're just not a candidate.
No, really. Is that what you do?
It really does. Yeah, I can't help them.
Right.
And, I'm not going to try. But more often than not, what they begin to be transparent about is that I'm afraid if we choose the wrong course, I'm afraid of what happens if we make a significant mistake here. And in those instances, that's really our opportunity to help them build process and methodology for their approach to the change initiative that begins to manage some of that discomfort and help increase the probability that they're going to see a successful outcome. But there's a critical point to all this. It's not just about them choosing the right outcome or choosing the right methodology. It's about them having the right disciplines as a leader and how they manage that change process with the people who are working in their organization that allows it to be successful. People get excited about methodology, and they can buy a lot of books on change, and there's some great ones out there. I mean, for people who are interested in any kind of change books, I'd recommend anything by John Cotter. He really knows what he's talking about, and he's probably the foremost authority, in my opinion, on change in organizations. But reading those books and having those methodologies doesn't enable the leader to get past his own shortcomings very often, and his ability to make that change successful.
So every good consultant has an acrostic or an acronym. Tell us about PERTH. Is that an acrostic or an acronym?
Well, no. PERTH is a tool set that we use as a part of what we do, and it's something that we've done in partnership with an author, Dr. Ted Prince, and he did significant research in evaluating the capacity of leaders to lead to profitability in the businesses that they run and operate. And it's pretty groundbreaking in its research, but really what it leads to is that profitability and value creation in terms of valuation change in organizations really correlates strictly to behavior. It comes down to a set of behaviors, and those behaviors can be measured, and in the fact that they can be measured, it can be predictive of outcomes, or it can lead to some very specific conversations about what needs to change from a leadership style standpoint to produce the desired outcome within the organization. So it's a component of the change strategy.
Oh, it is. It's a vital part of your change strategy that you bring to the company.
Absolutely. We would always evaluate leadership because it tells us a lot about their agility. It tells us about their natural inclinations to behave in ways that are going to produce positive outcomes. Because we don't want to change that just for the sake of change. We've done something that doesn't create the same level of profitability or desired level of outcome that the organization is going to experience.
Now, do you find yourself consulting as much with regard to what they should change as you are how to change, or is your practice focused in one area more than the other?
Well, we really do both. And
you do?
Yeah, we do, absolutely. And there are a lot of change organizations that really are focused on process and methodology. While we believe we bring great process and methodology to the table, we're also very interested in helping organizations think through that desired strategy change and what that strategy should look like for the organization on the backside of a change initiative. So we'll do significant evaluation of operational practice, strategic practice, market positioning, things of that nature to help provide them with options that they can look at and evaluate to more effectively choose an outcome that they can commit to and that they can really sell to the organization, create some momentum around.
Now, when you contract with one of your clients, what's the length of time, the process from when you first engage with them until where they're actually seeing some sort of results?
On the short side of that, it'd be in 6 to 9 months, you can see some significant change. I mean, as an example, we had an organization over in the UK that was experiencing some real resistance to change. They had a desired change strategy, but couldn't push past resistance in the organization due to some critical players within the team. Got involved with them, and a series of a week-long meeting. Went back a month later, another week-long meeting, and really just on the basis of those two small engagements, we were able to take the resistance that we were experiencing or that they were experiencing and not eliminate it, but to marginalize it. In other words, we made the resistance irrelevant to the plan of the organization.
Huh.
And in the process, they started to see some significant change within just about 60 days and 90 days out. But more typically, we would say that's it takes about 9 months to really start to see change around major change initiatives within an organization, a major operational restructuring, for example, or an operational model change to a business, which I'm working on one right now that involves 30,000 employees in a number of locations. That sort of change is an 18 to 24-month process before you really start to see the measurable outcomes of that organizational change. But you'll see change benefits in terms of motivation, enthusiasm, alignment within the organization, effectiveness of activities, and certainly alignment within the senior leadership team in a much more rapid period than that.
So you'll see that early on, even if you're looking at the scope of a 24-month engagement.
Right, but we don't consider a win if we've got enthusiasm in the management team and leadership team, and they say this is great, we're excited about what's happening, but we're not able to correlate that back to business benefit. Then that's
not a win for you.
It's not a win for us. That's a feel good for them, but we don't know that that's going to correlate to a business outcome.
Right,
and until it does, that's not really delivering the value that we expect to deliver to those people.
Sure. So everything is measurable that you do?
Absolutely, it has to be. It has to be. So now, obviously, the challenge in measuring those things is, you know, what contributes to what in terms of the outcomes in the business, but what we need to see and what allows us to feel that we've delivered the value we want is that the business is seeing the outcomes that they desire at some period out. And we talk about what that is. If 18 months out, they need to see some significant change in the cost structure of the business that allows them some flexibility in responding to market fluctuations. We've seen that as a specific case. Absolutely. 18 months out, we need to see that the fixed cost basis of their business has begun to decline and things have become more variable that allows them to respond with more agility to those changes. So that's a win for everybody in the organization.
When you have those kind of projects that last that length of time, is it something that at the end of those 24 months, now obviously you're in a different situation, so are they more open to this kind of recurring change where they're want tune-ups periodically down
and are they more ready for the next one? Is the culture more ready for the next change?
Absolutely. They realize that change wasn't fatal.
and it's not a one-time event. It's not like, oh, we fixed it, so thanks, bye, we'll see you.
Yeah, and what we want to do is we want to leave them equipped to manage the change process on their own. I mean, if they have to be dependent on us for change, then we've not really done our job. But if they leave that first engagement and experience and then suddenly they understand process-wise, methodology-wise, and certainly most importantly, leadership-wise, how to drive the change process, how to manage through resistance, how to deal with conflict. And your first guest, Dr. John Shufelt, made reference to the fact that you've got naysayers in the organization and they've got to learn how to embrace the people that are speaking contrarian to
the plan. Have a better idea.
Absolutely.
I mean, you don't want to shut them down completely, right?
Right. But at the same time, how do you embrace that feedback but then put limits to it so that
right.
it doesn't...
Right, but you don't want them to suck the energy out of every meeting.
That's true, too. Yeah.
Right. And so that's part of what we bring to the table is we bring process and methodology.
And the tools for them to kind of maximize all of their resources.
Absolutely. So those people can speak contrarian, it can be heard, but then it's decided on and it's moved on. And it's not allowed to be something that continually comes up. As a resistance point. And when that happens, they're equipped to do that on their own. And very often they'll have us come back on a periodic basis to revisit and review. But it's not there's no necessity to have us engaged on a full-time basis after they've had some success with the process. And that's really what we're looking to see happen with them.
Have you ever had a situation where the person that brought you on, you realized was the problem?
I'm going to hesitate to answer that.
He's going to take the fifth on that. I can see it right now.
let me go ahead and just say that I have
hypothetically.
I've never.
You might have heard of other people in other organizations.
I'll be blunt about this one. I've never encountered a change initiative where the person who brought us on didn't share some level of responsibility for the problem, but they're, by virtue of them being willing to bring us in, they've demonstrated that whatever the blind spot is, and 100% of the time, we find that there is a blind spot in the leader. I have those blind spots. You have those blind spots. We all share them. It's to what degree those blind spots are affecting us. We always find that they contribute in some degree. But what we also find is those with high agility are willing to hear that feedback, adapt to it, and make change happen that leads to the success that they really want to experience.
Oh, that's great. Sounds like you're on a fascinating engagement right now, and you've been very articulate about it. I haven't been able to pick up what's in it for me, but we'll talk about that off air. Listen, before we let you go, Randy, we have a little tradition, as you heard us with Dr. Shufelt a few moments ago, where we ask each guest to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career, and really more importantly, what they've learned for. Would you do that for us?
Absolutely. You know, I had the benefit of hearing you ask that question to your first guest, so I've had a little time to consider it. But one of my very first consulting engagements, when I started this business about 10 years ago, I very quickly saw what the target needed to look like. I got excited about the answer and was pretty passionate about it. And rather than help the client come to discover that that was the right answer for their organization, I started passionately selling for that outcome and that idea. And then I started to become the problem. I started overcoming their resistance to what I wanted to see happen. And it was a great learning experience because it gave me a picture. I had run businesses prior to coming into this role, but it gave me a great picture of what those CEOs were experiencing when they were trying to drive that change. And it was a big aha moment. It was a great learning experience because it allows me to understand now when I'm talking to them and I see their resistance, I can put myself in their shoes and remember why I tried to do that. And it was not a successful outcome to an engagement. So I learned a great lesson in the process. And at the end of the day, you know, been able to learn that really change is about getting people to embrace and understand that change, and it becomes their change. And when it does, that's what leads to great wins for everybody.
Yeah. Thanks for letting us and our listeners profit from your learning. When our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn more about the Walton Group and more about how to really effectively plan and execute change, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Well, they're certainly welcome to visit us on the web at www.waltongroup.net, and that's probably the best way to get in touch with us, and they can make contact with me. And we certainly love to hear from them.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Randy Walton with the Walton Group. Until next week, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, Randy Walton, Dr. John Shufelt, and the entire Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.